Got to turn our attention now to biomass and biofuels. Eric Affelbach is our guest. He's been with us in the past. So great to have him back, by the way. He's from Madison, president and CEO of Virent Energy Systems. Virent is a six-year-old energy technology company with some great goals, using cellulosic feedstuffs to replace fossil fuels in a cost-effective way. I'm really pleased to have him back. And certainly, if you have questions as we move along and talking about biomass and biofuels, I know there are a lot of questions out there. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. So contact us. We'll be glad to get you on the air. And Eric, welcome back.
Good to be back.
It's really great to have you back. Tell us, I gave a sort of a thumbnail on Virent, but to talk a little bit more about your company.
Virent's a really interesting company because we are one of the first companies to use catalysts, solid-state catalysts that are much like a refinery, oil refinery operation, to convert biomass into hydrocarbon fuels. So these fuels are identical to the fuels you get today. So it's gasoline and jet fuel are two of the first primary fuels that we're looking at developing.
So you've been going now 6 years.
Yes.
How are things going?
Well, in startups, we always say, it's like dog years. Time seems to stand still. But no, the company's done great. We've grown to 75 people. We've got a second building under construction. We've got some incredibly valuable partnerships with Shell Oil and Honda. We've got Cargill as an investor. And these strategic relationships in combination with what we're doing on the technology side really give us the confidence that we can scale the business to be a true global fuel supplier.
Well, the great thing about your ideas and your research to me, or one of the great ideas, is that it's gas, it's fuel that can be put right into the system. I mean, we wouldn't have to build a new infrastructure if I'm understanding you correctly.
That is absolutely correct. And I think people underestimate the importance of that. Any time you change anything, especially as something as comprehensive as our global fuel system, it is a lot of momentum to overcome if you're going to change that. You've got new tanks, new gas pumps, new automotive fuel systems. And it really is a big advantage of ours, I think, to save all of the money on the capital equipment and the logistics costs, et cetera. So we see it as a big advantage, and we think that's where all the biofuels will be headed to.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, the prospects for renewable energy companies, I think they really soared with rising oil prices. Now we've what was oil this morning? $64 a barrel.
I don't watch it anymore.
It goes up and it goes. Now it's on the down. It's going down the other way. But I'm wondering, a reversal in oil prices, is that removed at least temporarily? Maybe a rationale for investors to pump a lot of money into alternatives.
We don't think so. Clearly, it would be a short-term profitability issue. If you are producing today, you're going to have your gross margin squeezed. The reality is, though, for a development stage company like we are, long-term, people believe we're going to be running short of oil and that we have a very real CO2 problem in the globe that has to be addressed with solutions like ours. And the long-term partner viewpoints we've got with Honda, Shell, and Cargill are nice in times like this as well, because they're after those long-term issues. They're not after next quarter's profitability and results. And we believe that oil will probably stay in the 60 up to 100 range, kind of trading here shortly. And longer term, meaning 5 to 10 years, it's probably going to be going back up above 100 on skyward again.
So it's not going to stay low.
Right. Not my belief anyway, although predicting the future, I've kind of given up on that now.
You mentioned CO2, and I think it's important to for you to discuss why biomass is important in this regard.
Right. I think, you know, people looked at ethanol as a first tier, a first generation biofuel, and there was some consumption of natural gas, and you do have to burn some fossil fuels to grow the crops, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think what you'll see in the next generation biofuels across the board is that there's much lower carbon footprint, and we call it field to wheels kind of carbon footprint. And our process is very low. Clearly, you still have to burn some fossil fuels to plant and fertilize and transport fuels. But we think that that is a huge driver. And we think that with proper sustainable biomass efforts, you will be able to displace a large portion of the petroleum fuel base.
Eric Affelbach, our guest today, president and CEO of Viron Energy Systems. We're talking with him about his company and about biomass and biofuels. Certainly, if you have some questions, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Viron was awarded a $2 million grant from the National Institutes for Standards and Technologies, and part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, I think, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Yep. How are you using that grant money?
That grant is targeted at getting to the cellulosic portion of the biomass. Since we have a different conversion process, meaning we are catalytic instead of using bugs to digest sugars, mm-hmm. we have a different set of parameters we're looking at, and we think we can be much lower cost basis, which at the end of the day for all these new technologies is what's important. You have to be able to make money or you're not going to be scalable. Nobody will use your product. We wish we could get a premium for a bio-based gasoline, but in reality, you can't. So that effort really goes after utilizing the low-cost sugars that don't compete with the food supply, two key issues for scalability, mm-hmm. and we're getting very good results from that. And our catalyst, because it's not a bug, it doesn't need to see a certain type of sugar in order to digest it. We found that we have much better flexibility on those types of feedstocks than a bug-based ethanol process would have.
So what kind of biomass can you use in your process?
We are looking at a number of different things. We've looked at sugarcane bagasse, so the actual plant that comes with the sugarcane when you press the sugar juice out of the plant. That's one. We've looked at things like bran, so corn carbohydrates, five carbon sugars that are actually a waste stream coming out of a current ethanol plant. So their bugs will go in and eat the 6-carbon glucose sugar. They will not eat the 5-carbon sugar, so they just put those in cattle feed or throw them away. That's a good example of a sugar that's basically cheap or very almost free.
Yeah.
So we would take those sugars, use them in our process, and produce gasoline.
Interesting. Sean in Milwaukee has a question or comment for you. Sean, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I had worked with a researcher for New Mexico State University, and he was growing different types of weed, Russian thistle or tumbleweed, pigweed or amaranthus, which the farmers down there battle constantly, and growing those for cellulosic ethanol research. And he had different species of amaranthus from all over the world. There is one variety from Florida that, I mean, it got like a small tree. It got 15, 20 feet tall, and, you know, at the base was 5 to 8 inches in diameter. And just wondering what your guest thinks about the potential of cellulosic ethanol production from plants like that.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly important topic on which type of biomass feedstock that you choose. We believe that most cost-effective biorefineries will have feedstocks that have a 10 to 20 ton per acre type yield of carbohydrates. And these are plants that will be engineered probably to be high biomass. So you're going to see things like the grasses. People are working with switchgrass and miscanthus and amongst other things. You're going to see things like high biomass sorghum and sweet sorghum. You're going to see things like sugar beets that have been genetically modified to have very high sugar contents. And what we look for is the total cost of getting biomass from about a 50-mile radius into a plant. And that plant, we would say, we would want to be able to produce about 100 million gallons of fuel a year. And the cost, if you saw the cost curve, goes way down with the radius that you're pulling the biomass from. And that's why the yield per acre is so incredibly important. And the other thing is they're engineering these crops to not need as much fertilizer or water or be drought resistant. And I think some of the grasses and weeds that you mentioned have some of those attributes that they're trying to get those traits into other crops so they can maximize the carbohydrate yield but minimize fertilizer and water usage.
It's interesting. Thanks, Sean. I appreciate your call very much. What about this? You talked about a catalytic converter, and what is that process, or basically what is that process?
It's very interesting. First, our process steps are very similar to what goes on in a current oil refinery. I like to tell people that carbohydrates are really, you know, they're long chains of carbon with hydrogen and oxygen on them. All we do is take the oxygen off, do a few other steps, and now you've got a hydrocarbon like gasoline. So it's actually not that complicated. In fact, that's where the crude oil came from in the first place, was the plants, you know, getting millions of years underground, did that same kind of, you know, the oxygen was taken off the molecules. So our catalyst basically is there, and a catalyst activates, basically lowers the activation energy that our chemical reaction happens with. So we see our reactants come in, sugar and water. They go towards the catalyst. The catalyst enables specific reaction steps that allows us to take this oxygen off, and we actually make water through that sequence of reactions. So this is one of our advantages, too. We make water, and we take the oxygen off. We do one other step that basically gets us into the same property range, so octane, vapor pressure, everything else that you see in gasoline.
Yeah.
And so with a few basic steps, now you can go and replicate and create those molecules just like they did. We just save, you know, 16 million years in the process.
Eric Affelbach, our guest today here on the IdeasNet as we talk biomass and biofuels on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking biomass and biofuels now on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Eric Affelbach. Been with us before. He's from Madison, president and CEO of Viren Energy Systems, working on six-year-old energy tech company, and they're working on using cellulosic feedstuffs to replace our fossil fuels and do it in a way that is cost-effective and can make investors some money, which makes that's the only way it's going to work. That's pretty much it. If you'd like to join in, maybe you've got some questions, concerns about it, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, send us an email. We'll be glad to get you on. And Mark in Racine is up with a question. Mark, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I've got a couple of comments. One is there is a scientist, I believe it's at MIT, who has just come up with a process which basically duplicates photosynthesis, allowing basically the separation of oxygen from carbon, and the carbon can then be stored as sugars, that looks like it's going to be inexpensive and pretty effective and be able to be used in an industrial scale. So I think that's pretty promising. Another thing is a guy in Belgium has developed a system whereby they basically take seawater and they spray it through a chamber of compressed carbon dioxide from that's been sequestered from smokestack outputs. Now the water contains algae, and now with a high percentage of carbon dioxide in it, it's run through transparent tubes in a sun field, and the algae consumes the carbon dioxide, converts it into mass, and at the end, this now fibrous sort of gelled seawater can be sort of osterized and the solids separated out and the water reused. I was wondering if your process would be able to use anything like this. This latter method can be attached to a conventional power plant and could be used in, say, arid parts of the country where the piping can be placed without interrupting the commercial use of the land.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question. There's two parts to that. And we kind of view the world as anywhere we can get cheap carbohydrates is great. So one of the things that's going on right now in the world are there's probably 10 or 12 startup companies that I've seen all working with algae. And the reason for that is because algae, I mentioned 20 tons per acre is kind of the peak for a highly engineered bioenergy crop on the land. Algae probably, on paper anyway, can achieve 2 to 3 times that in terms of carbohydrates per acre. And obviously, you're not using farmland now. You're using any space you've got with sunlight. So Shell actually has a joint venture they're doing in Maui right now it's called HR Biopetroleum, but they're looking at algae production as a feedstock. On paper, it looks fantastic. There are a lot of engineering issues that have to be resolved, but they look very doable. So we're monitoring that, and if we get cheap carbohydrates out of that stream, we certainly would use them as a feedstock to our process. Some of the other things that we've seen in the some of these new processes, like you mentioned this MIT professor, if they can replicate the creation of any carbohydrate-type molecule, we can use it in our stream very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So we love to see that. We do believe that with all the money and brains that have been pointed at these issues mm-hmm. over the last couple of years, that there are going to be some very disruptive, highly effective things that will come out and change the industry faster than I think people realize.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
Are you producing like a biodiesel and basically an oleaceous molecule, or are you producing alcohols?
We produce actual gasoline, so
okay,
and jet fuel. So they're all alkanes, branch chains. We do produce aromatics if
uh-huh.
needed in the fuel system, and those are critical for jet fuel and even automotive fuel
systems.
Okay,
that's very reassuring. I think that alcohol production, basically the only energy you get out of it is electrical energy you put in, and you're simply putting the pollution someplace else other than the production site. So,
right. Yeah, we can make alcohols, but yeah, we just said why do that when you can make real gasoline?
Yeah. Thanks, Mark, for calling.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Ron in Newburgh is up next. Ron, hello to you.
Yes, good afternoon. You partially answered the question. When you start off with switchgrass or whatever, is your first step formation of an alcohol, or are you doing something other than fermentation?
We are not doing fermentation. We actually go right from a solubilized carbohydrate. So if you just think of any carbohydrate dissolved in water, we take that and we put it right into a catalytic reactor that starts to take the oxygen off the molecule. And then we do a condensation reaction on those intermediates. And in fact, I might mention that our website has an extremely good white paper that we posted about 3 or 4 weeks ago because our patents actually published. So we put together a white paper that, for those of you that really love chemistry and love technology, I would recommend going in there. Our website is www.virent.com, and you can download that. And again, you're going to want to have a technology background to read that. We We went full scale on the technology for that white paper.
That's fine, because I'm a chemical engineer.
Well, you're going to love it, then. You can cozy up next to a fire.
Okay, and how do you spell the name of your company?
It's Virent, V-I-R-E-N-T.
Okay, and one other question. A couple years ago, the newsletter from Madison, from the campus, sent out that they had a process that was making something other than alcohol, but I think it was an oxygenated material, if I remember right. Do you know what they're doing at all?
It may have referred to Dr. Jim Demesik, who's one of our founders, actually. He's a globally renowned catalyst expert. He is one of the founders, and he came up with a process for HMF.
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Right, and yep. HMF is... been one of these molecules that people said, well, you can make that into diesel fuel or jet fuel and other things. And he made that out of fructose. So it's an interesting process. It's going to be difficult to do that economically. And what we're doing is actually very much simpler than that. So Jim works on core research, and so we collaborate quite a bit with his lab on things that we'd like to see, and we actually fund a research program in his lab.
Okay, thank you. And you may want to tell the rest of the folks that are listening what HMF stands for.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's hexamethylfuran.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Rod, for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions as we talk biomass and biofuels with our guest today, Eric Appelbach. And Joe in La Crosse is up next. Joe, hello.
Holy smokes. I am not a chemical engineer. I'm more of an anarchist. I was wondering if there's any studies on hemp as a biomass fuel.
I've seen a few, but generally the yield per acre of the biomass from that hasn't been as high as some of these other crops like prairie grass and miscanthus and sorghum. So they tend to go after maximum yield per acre on the crop, and I don't think hemp has made the cut.
No, all right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Earlier this month, Governor Doyle spoke at the Bioenergy Summit. Just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was sponsored by the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative. What role does the bioenergy play in the governor's Clean Energy Wisconsin plan?
Well, it's a very big part of trying to offset CO2. That's one of his major initiatives with many of these things. All of the renewable energy platforms are CO2 production, you know, trying to reduce that. Also, energy independence is a big tenet there, although that's more of a national issue. And that's why the state is focused on helping so many renewable-type platforms get a start. And he's been a big proponent for it. He's been helpful. We just got $1 million, $500,000 in grant and $500,000 in loans from the Office of Energy Independence, which is a new office he just formed to really focus and have some talent directed at that effort. And I think that's another indication of, you know, even in these tough times, you've got to make those investments to make those technologies really contribute.
Yeah, and how are you using the money?
We're currently under construction in a new building and scale up. So most of what Virent's doing now is to prove we can run our process in a commercial fashion at scale. And our target is, again, to hit 100 million gallon a year plant, but that's probably 3 to 5 years out. And right now we've got a new process that's got to be tested at smaller sizes first. And that's what our second building will house.
So that's a whole new process from what you were working on before.
Well, it's when I say new process, it's relative to anything anybody's done before. Our back half kind of looks like a oil refinery. Our front half looks like, well, is the new part. People don't put water into the front end of an oil refinery. So I think some of those things we're doing and all of our intellectual property is wrapped around those key process steps. So it's easy to run these things at small scale, but then when you say, okay, it's got to run 24/7, everything's got to be automated, the control systems have to be there, you know, a real world plant is much has a lot higher requirements that we have to prove before we go build a full-scale plant. We think that a 100-million-gallon plant might cost $250 million to build. So you can imagine people don't want to risk that until they've proven that everything works day in and day out.
But you can. But even with that cost of building that plant, you say should be able to make money on it.
Right, exactly. One of the things, if you look at all biofuels, you're kind of caught between two commodity chains. You've got the biomass on one side, and you've got the fuel on the other side. We can't change the price of fuel. Gasoline's going to sell for what the petro complex sells it for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat the same on the biomass side. We have to make sure we have cheap feedstocks. So you've got to operate between there, and the margins are never that big. The yield that you get from and the price that you pay for that biomass feedstock is the key. It's the largest contributor to your profitability, whether it's ethanol, biodiesel, or our process. And this is why you see the volatility going on in the industry now is actually biodiesel, I think, is operating at 15 to 20% of capacity now because it's just unprofitable for most plants.
Lots of callers. Dan and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I was just curious to know if you have done any studies or if you know of any studies of kind of environmental impact on harvesting native grasses for this kind of use versus kind of the more traditional method of burning it, and whether or not, it still sort of regenerates the same, at sort of the same rate and is as effective as burning.
Mm-hmm. We haven't done any studies like that, but the USDA has done quite a bit, and right now at the University of Wisconsin, they've got a Great Lakes Bioenergy Center project with DOE that's about $135 million effort. They are the sustainability center for that whole effort. So they're doing a lot of studies on what is truly long-term sustainable for the soil and the crop itself. And I think what you'll see over the next few years is very detailed analyses of these different crops and what is truly sustainable versus not. I personally haven't seen one comparing the burning of prairie grasses versus the, in essence, the harvesting.
Yeah, and that bioenergy research center is just finished its first year, I believe. So they're in the process. Is it a 4-year or is it a 5-year? I can't remember now.
I believe it's 5 years.
I think it's 5 years, $135 million. And that's something that they really are looking at very, very carefully. Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Frank in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Frank.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to be a real proponent of biofuels, biomass. Since changed my mind because of the pressure it's going to put on the world food supply, and especially we've just already seen what's happened with corn and in Mexico and how it's put much pressure on that. And since your main source will be carbohydrates, and that is the main source of food for most people in the world is carbohydrates, I would like you to comment on how much pressure that is going to put on the world food supply. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to approach that. One is it really can't compete with food or it won't be a long-term sustainable business. And I think that's what you're seeing right now. Corn is not the optimal feedstock for a bioenergy crop. It's a political and lobbying solution to a biofuel. That's not long-term sustainable. That's where all of these other genetically engineered crops that have high carbohydrates but grow on marginal lands, don't require the fertilizer or water that corn does, can be grown in other climates. That's where you're going to see the final long-term sustainable part of biofuels end up. It's a big transition to make to think of these crops, a few years ago as only food. Now suddenly it's got to be food and fuel. What we view will happen is you'll see energy crops grown in one way and treated in a whole different policy manner than the food crops, Right now, everything's intermingled, and it's somewhat a legacy issue. Corn is not the best feedstock, and slowly we will get away from that. I think the government's going to have to help lead that change, though. Right now, the policy in the U.S. does not help lead that change. It actually hinders it.
All right. Thank you for calling. Jeremy in Sheboygan, we're on to you now. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm driving home on my lunch break, and I'm seeing, at least from a complete non-chemical engineer standpoint, is an abundance of already harvesting source, and that's domestic lawn. This is something that, and I think if I'm asking the question, probably a lot of listeners are, is why couldn't we harvest something that's already being harvested on a regular basis, which would kind of eliminate a lot of the problems that the previous callers have been alluding to?
Yeah, it really gets into a cost issue. If you can get any biomass to a plant gate for a reasonable price, by all means, get it to the plant gate and sell it. There's always a issue with lawns is that it's so distributed over a large area that you end up, if everybody threw a bag of cut grass in their car and drove it to a collection facility, you'd end up burning as much gas as you probably made. It really is that whole scale versus cost equation that you've got to get underneath. We still model almost everything we see is plant a dedicated high yield energy crop, you know, and probably in reality, a highly engineered crop, you're only going to need a 20-mile radius from your plant to produce 100 million gallons of fuel, and it will be very efficient to do it that way.
Wow. Thank you, Jeremy, for calling. I want to go to Gene in Ashland next. Gene, hello to you.
Hello. I was wondering if you have any information on the overall time span projected for the development of these new processes that would outcompete coal and nuclear plants before they get going.
Well, coal and nuclear primarily are used to generate electricity, and we don't do that. We're actually in the transportation fuel business, so we're not really competitive with that. If you look at, you know, I do know quite a bit about that space, though, and what you will see is that wind and solar is coming down quickly. Coal is very inexpensive, though. So if anything, what you'll see is that some of the cost of carbon-type legislation that will probably happen in the next 12 to 18 months will increase the cost of making electricity from carbon polluters, carbon generators like coal. And that will actually probably make it break even between wind and coal. And that's why you see people like Boone Pickens, you know, with his plan on, you know, build the wind towers, get them up, displace the coal with wind, and then utilize other resources for transportation fuel. Nuclear, I believe, you know, there's no CO2 emission of any substance from a nuclear plant, and I think the U.S. should be building nuclear plants, and I think you will see them building nuclear plants over the next 8 years.
What about your, and by the way, thank you, Gene, for calling. Let's take a look ahead into the future, and what would you see? Let's say your plan works, and what can we expect down the road?
I think there's a very, very interesting convergence of two things that are going on in transportation right now. One is you're seeing the electrification of the car platform, and it's accelerating. Part of that started with the fuel cell cars. Those were all electric cars with hydrogen generating the electricity. Now you're seeing plug-in hybrids. Lithium-ion batteries are only going to have energy density that will get up to maybe 60 miles of range. It's going to be very difficult. But if you take a plug-in hybrid with 60-mile range, that knocks out about 60% of the petroleum usage that we have. The other 40% could be covered with biofuels. So now if you think about that, now you've gone from we use 160 billion gallons of gasoline in this country right now every year. You've taken that from all petroleum to zero petroleum. Now, you do have to generate the electrons in a carbon-neutral way that are going into all those batteries at night. So again, that's why you need the wind, the solar, and the nuclear. Otherwise, if you burn coal to do that, you're just switching one problem for the other in terms of the global warming issue.
But we could someday, maybe in our lifetime, we're going to see that?
Oh, I believe so. The electrical car platforms, Honda's, again, one of our partners. The fuel cell car that Honda has is just a phenomenal piece of machinery. The big issue that has is the energy density of putting hydrogen on that platform is very difficult. There are a lot of engineering issues. You cannot beat a gallon of gasoline for energy density. It's something like 10 to 20x what the best lithium ion battery is.
And on that note, Eric, we have to close. Email address is, again, virent.com. I'm sorry, web address, virent.com. Take a look at that to find out more about what he's doing. Eric Affelbach, president of Virent Energy Systems.